Vermont Viewpoint is a public affairs program produced and funded by WDEV and the Radio Vermont Group. We welcome listener feedback. Email your comments to vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com.
Good morning. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV. I'm Rick Singeri. When we've discussed water issues in the past, so much of the focus has been on lake cleanup and lessening the phosphate runoff from farms, non-porous surfaces in our yards, also on groundwater. Absolutely vital stuff that the state is heavily invested in correcting. But today, we're going to talk about issues that involve surface water, environmental resilience, and interbasin water transfer. And just because you might not have heard much about this before doesn't mean that they aren't important. We have a panel of individuals with us this hour to explain why this is a concern and what needs to be done to rectify it. Joining us is Kathy Erfer, river steward for the Connecticut River Conservancy. Kathy, welcome to Vermont Viewpoint.
Thanks, Rick. Good morning.
Good morning. We also have Jared Carpenter, who is vice chair of the Vermont Council of Trout Unlimited and president of the Mad Dog chapter of Trout Unlimited. Jared, thank you for joining us.
Good morning. Great to be here. Thank you.
Good morning. And Mason Overstreet, a professor of law in Vermont Law School's Environmental Advocacy Clinic. Mason, welcome back to Vermont Viewpoint.
Oh, thank you, Rick. Glad to be here.
All right. Great to have you back. Listeners, if you'd like to ask our guests about surface water and Act 183, you can give us a call at 244-1777 or 877-291-8255. You can email vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. All right. Let's start with each of you kind of telling us about yourselves, your respectful organizations. Kathy, I'll start with you.
So, again, as you said, a river steward for Connecticut River Conservancy. I essentially pay a lot of attention to the eastern half of Vermont and the western half of New Hampshire, focused on protecting the Connecticut River and its watershed.
Jared?
So, yeah, a little bit about Trout Unlimited. We're an organization dedicated to protection and restoration of cold water fisheries, which, of course, drew our attention to this issue. The Vermont Council of Trout Unlimited, as you mentioned, is the statewide organization, and I'm the president of the Mad Dog chapter, which is so named after the Mad River and the Dog Rivers, which are tributaries of the Winooski. And our membership is in Washington County and Lamoille and up into Caledonia and the Kingdom. So we're the local TU chapter of the five chapters that are in the state.
All right. I'm glad you straightened out the Mad Dog chapter thing for me. I was getting a little worried. Yep, that's good.
Yeah, it's always important. It's named after rivers, not the mentality.
All right, good. And Mason, go right ahead.
So I'm a staff attorney at the Environmental Advocacy Clinic at Vermont Law School, and we are a nonprofit public interest environmental litigation and policy law firm housed at the law school. And we've been working with a diverse coalition, including Jared and Kathy here, on this surface water issue here in Vermont, but we also work nationwide on environmental issues that run the gamut.
And Mason, on this surface water issue, are there more groups in the coalition?
Yes, there are. And actually, Kathy or Jared, if you'd like to speak to that, that'd be wonderful.
Go ahead, Kathy.
Sure. It includes several of the TU chapters and also VNRC, Vermont Natural Resources Council, and Jim Murphy from Mason, help me with this.
From the National Wildlife Federation.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And how did this all get started, Kathy?
Well, basically, all of us as individual organizations will often, comment on permits. And a permit came in front of us that we were commenting on that gave us some concern, which was basically this first sort of interbasin transfer. And so this is Killington, I guess a couple of years ago now. They were proposing to transfer water for snowmaking by pumping it up and over the mountain, essentially pumping out of the Ottauquechee River, using it for snowmaking, pumping it over the mountain, and then it would drain into the Otter Creek watershed. And so the idea of an interbasin transfer is problematic because a couple things. One, you know, you may have a situation where you're taking pollutants from one watershed and you're moving it into another watershed. And certainly for the Lake Champlain watershed, we don't want to be adding any phosphorus. You can be moving pathogens from one watershed to another shed, watershed. And there's also, you know, a question of diverting the water from the downstream users, right? So if you're taking water from upstream area and moving it out of a watershed, those downstream users don't have access to that water. So when we collectively started working on, you know, commenting on this permit, we realized that there was little understanding in the state about, there's no policy at all on interbasin transfers, and there's little understanding of diversions and pumping out of our surface water, you know, rivers and lakes. So it sort of, you know, raised the red flag for us. It caused us concern to realize that the state actually has no idea how many people might be pumping out of our surface waters and what they're using it for.
And, go ahead, Kat.
So we started to work together to try to find a way for the state to begin to look at this and at least dig into the problem.
And Mason, you know, we've heard of groundwater quite a bit. It's a term that we've all become pretty comfortable with. Surface water is a fairly new one to me. So explain what surface water is, how it differs from groundwater.
Absolutely, Rick. So when we're talking about surface water with this specific issue, we're talking about navigable streams, rivers, and lakes in Vermont. Groundwater is a separate issue, and there are laws, and there's actually a permitting regime that applies to groundwater. Surface waters are completely different.
All right. Now, Jared, most people tend to think of Vermont as a water-rich state. Is that still the case?
I think, well, compared to many other states, yes, but I think what you're seeing happen with climate change and precipitation events is you're starting to see fluctuations. I mean, we can see it. We certainly saw it last summer when we were talking about this issue. By the time we hit August, September, folks will know, you know, TU membership, you know, who are anglers, notice when they're out on the river, recreationalists and others notice that water levels have gotten really low. And there's a lot of competing uses for different amounts of water. And we're starting to see fluctuations with, you know, periods of drought. And then rather than, you know, we've had a wet spell for the past 2 weeks. But during the summertime, you really get those, you know, those real bursts of downpours that come through rather than the gentle rain. And what we're starting to see in this state in the last couple of years, and really a snapshot in the last 5 or 6 weeks, if folks will remember that it was really warm about 5 or 6 weeks ago, and the water levels were really low for springtime, and the water temperatures were really warm for where they should have been. And now we've hit a rainy period where the water levels are higher, you know, and we're seeing, you know, higher levels, and, you know, grass is growing and everything like that, but we could, you know, we will very well probably hit this cycle of drought again for another couple of weeks, and then it'll cycle in and out. So Vermont is wet compared to other states, certainly out in the Southwest, but we're starting to see, and what is concerning is the changing, the fluctuations in river levels and how that impacts not only use by, you know, commercial and agricultural entities, but of course recreation and then aquatic habitat as well. So that's really what we're starting to see, and that's the concern.
And Jared, let's take that a little bit further. You know, how does that impact the fish that swim in these bodies of water, the wildlife that rely on these bodies of water?
Well, it of course depends on, you know, the type of fish, of course, but it depends on the size of the river. I mean, you're going to see some of the bigger water bodies are going to, like the Winooski, for example, is a larger river. Once it gets below Waterbury and down towards Burlington, it's a pretty large water body, which has some deep pools and some deep pockets where fish can hide out. But when you get up into the smaller tributaries, say the Upper Mad River, the Dog, get up towards the Winooski River, up towards Cabot, and some other areas where it's a much smaller river, you're going to have a much bigger impact on these, due to these temperature, these precipitation fluctuations, where trout in particular aren't equipped to handle, you know, water temperatures to get above 68 degrees for an extended period of time. So you're going to see real impacts on species. And then going down the food chain on the invertebrates, the insects that are required for feeding, and then, of course, larger animals as well, as more and more are concentrated on trying to get, you know, a valuable water source that is, you know, that is dwindling and warming up.
Kathy Erfer, taking a step back, let's talk about the problem. First of all, is there a problem in the state of Vermont?
Yeah, there is. I mean, you know, with the, you know, as Jared mentioned, the climate change, drought coming, more pressure from additional industrial users, and then also, you know, a lot of people moving into the state, like our water, the hydrologic cycle is changing, and our water uses are going to be more intense. And so we really need to be proactive and, frankly, protect the riparian folks who have been using water for, you know, hundreds of years, really. I mean, if you think about a situation where you may have, like, a farmer who for several decades, several generations has been taking water out of the stream for irrigation or for cows, and then if you have users move in upstream and that water is no longer available to that farmer, right now their only recourse is to, you know, try to be neighborly and go ask their upstream neighbor to save them a little water. And if the answer is no, you know, you can take them to court. That's it. Like, that's our system at the moment. And so, you know, one analogy that I was thinking of is, you know, if you're, it's like being in a restaurant blindfolded with a straw and a drink, and you don't know if there are other people at the table who also have the straw in your drink. You don't want to hit the bottom of the drink because you don't know when the waitress is going to come and refill it. And if you hit the bottom and make that slurping sound, you have in fact killed something. So, you know, ideally it'd be nice to take the blindfolds off so that we kind of know, you know, collectively, sure, how much we're drinking.
Well, Mason, Kathy paints the kind of legal picture of what recourse that farmer would have, for instance, if all of a sudden there's someone upstream using water and it affects their business. So let's talk about the legal side of it. How has that been, you know, decided on in former cases here in the state when something like this happens?
Yeah, so Rick, good question. Typically, to date, the system that Kathy is talking about is this system called riparian rights or riparianism. And it dates back to actually Old English times, and it's common law. So that means it's judge-made or judge-derived law. And to date, it has worked. That system has worked in Vermont. However, what Kathy and Jared were talking about several minutes ago is that that system is now in a place where it may no longer work for Vermont because it is reactive, not proactive. It's costly to riparian landowners, and it's not forward-thinking and protective of our surface waters, right? So it's kind of a last-stop resort.
So it's when you start hearing that, like Kathy said, the slurping through the straw when you've reached the bottom, that maybe something will get rectified, and that's not the time you want that to happen. Jared, are there new industrial surface water users that are coming online in Vermont that have you all concerned?
Yes, I think it's not anyone in particular, and because nobody here wants to point fingers, because what you're talking about is the overall use, not just all of a sudden there's one thing, you know, one aspect that suddenly has changed the use. You have to, you know, getting towards the glass being half full or half empty again, you're talking about climate change, and you're talking about maybe less water in the river than there was before for the current users. But then you also have other people who are starting to rely on that water as well, and it's about certainty and making sure that not only is water left in the river for recreation and habitat, but there's certainty amongst users. Now, you know, agriculture has always been a big user in terms of, you know, water consumption. There are some, as the hemp industry starts here in the state, and, of course, cannabis coming up as well. One's going to assume that that's going to start being a crop. Hops, IPA, hops takes a lot of water to grow, and there are some industrial users in terms of, you know, brewers and others. But this isn't about any just sort of suddenly there's one new user who's come in where this has become a concern. This is a combination of a lot of different people, a lot of different users, and then, of course, you know, residential office and surface waters as well. A lot of different users coming in and trying to use a potentially dwindling resource and making sure that there's certainty in use, and then, of course, certainty that you're going to protect the habitat and protect the recreational opportunities that come with it that our state relies on so much as well.
So, Mason, Kathy had painted this picture of what happened there at Killington. You all looked at that proposal for the snowmaking. What happened after that?
So after that, Rick, the coalition, like Kathy said, you know, really there was an aha moment. Also with the state, where the Killington Interbasin Transfer really highlighted that there is a problem and that there's a sizable regulatory hole right now in regards to surface water diversions. And so the coalition tightened, and Kathy and Jared can speak to it, but basically we worked with state legislators to develop legislation this past legislative session, which was passed. Jared and Kathy, would you like to speak to that?
Sure. So what was passed was essentially a study committee bill. And so there is a study group that is taking the time over this calendar year to meet that, you know, represents a lot of different stakeholders in the process. You know, environmental groups, some industrial users, the state, et cetera, to, you know, consider this, look at the, you know, what currently exists in the state, and then, you know, consider, you know, hear from some examples from other states around the country, and then consider what might be a proactive pathway forward. And so those folks are meeting, you know, sort of monthly or bi-monthly, and then they will be producing a final report in December. And so, you know, there should be information in that report that will pave the way for what, you know, what the best steps might be going forward.
And Kathy, when you spoke to legislators to kind of bring this to their attention, were any aware that this was, you know, the situation in the state, or had any real knowledge of what was going on in regard to surface water?
I'll answer that. I'll let Jared answer that because he ends up speaking to legislators more often than I do.
Great.
I'm in the lower corner of the state. But I will say from the perspective of the state staff, they this is a hole that they're concerned about, and you know, they also agree that there should be some sort of remedy to try to figure out how to be proactive about this going forward.
Mm-hmm. Jared, if you can tell us what reaction you got, what knowledge legislators did have about what was going on as far as surface water.
I think, obviously some more than others, but I think anecdotally, they're also hearing, they're seeing it themselves, and they're hearing it from constituents' concerns and water levels. I think from a matter of, you know, gaps in the regulations and what the state can respond to, or the lack of state response, and how the issue, how we need to gather more information and we need to analyze the plausible solutions. I think in that regard, this was a learning curve for all of us in terms of trying to figure out how we plot a path forward to look towards solutions. I think it's something that you know, hadn't been considered as much anymore. Hadn't been considered as much by many legislators.
And as far as this the bill, it was H-833. It's now Act 173, so it did pass the House and Senate, went to the governor who signed it into law. Did he make comment on it, Jared? I think it was last October when he did sign Act 173.
You know, last October seems like it was about 5 years ago.
It was. It actually was.
Yeah, exactly. 3 days ago seems like 5 years ago.
Yeah.
I don't recall. I don't believe that he did. He did sign it, but I don't recall whether or not there was comments when he did sign.
All right. And, you know, looking at Act 173, Jared, what is the study group tasked with, and, you know, what will the timeline be for the group?
So the group is going to be, as Kathy said, it's a mix of legislators, of agency staff, and of, you know, citizens representing different interests. And they're going to be meeting periodically during the summer to analyze the issue, to gather information, to look at the problem, look at the gaps, and then, offer plausible solutions to the legislature. Guys, correct me if I'm wrong on the timeline, but their goal is to offer solutions and a report back by January of 2022 to the legislature about plausible next steps. We're open to all sorts of solutions, but we really are concerned that we need to start examining a solution to this problem, and that's what this study group is going to do over the summer.
We're going to take a break for a CBS News update. When we return, we'll continue our discussion on surface water and Act 173. Listeners, if you want to join the conversation, you can give us a call at 244-1777. Toll free, it's 877-291-8255. You can email vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV.
Let our staff at the Warren Store ease you back into a pre-pandemic lifestyle. We can cater your postponed events and even bake you a custom cake. We can dress you in comfortable casual clothing. Make it a day trip for the best one-stop shopping in Vermont. Have lunch on our deck, head upstairs for some much-needed retail therapy, then treat yourself to a specialty coffee from our new espresso machine. You can pick up a colorful Warren Store beach towel for a dip in the river, and how about a delicious house-made ice cream sandwich? Fun, funky, safe, and friendly. Warren Store, Main Street, Warren Village, and warrenstore.com.
Welcome back to Vermont Viewpoint. I'm Rick Sengary. With me this morning are Kathy Erfer of the Connecticut River Conservancy, Jared Carpenter of Trout Unlimited, and Mason Overstreet of Vermont Law School's Environmental Advocacy Clinic. Listeners, we're discussing issues involving surface water and interbasin water transfers. And if you've got a question for our panel, you can give us a call, 244-1777 or 877-291-8255. You can also email vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. Mason, what are possible solutions to the problem that you've identified?
Yeah, so Rick, going back to what we were speaking about earlier, the old English common law, Vermont is one of the few remaining pure riparian rights states, okay? And the majority of eastern states in the United States have thought about similar problems to what we're discussing today, and they have developed these kind of blanket water management systems, basically where they implement that common law riparianism framework into a proactive structure in the form of kind of a statewide permitting regime.
Kathy, do you see this? You know, the Connecticut River Conservancy includes, you know, New Hampshire, Mass, Connecticut. Have you seen how it's been handled in any of these states that could inform us and help us here in Vermont?
Yeah, all three states actually have something in place. You know, it looks slightly different in each state. But New Hampshire, as an example, has the instant flow program that they just piloted on two of the rivers probably about 8 years ago, and they have now expanded it to all of what they consider the designated rivers. So New Hampshire has certain rivers that get special protections. Connecticut's one of them. And so that is a system where they essentially are setting a baseline kind of ecological, you know, a certain amount of water that you need to support the things that rely on the streams for their lives, right? We're sort of setting that baseline and then working with the users to identify how much they need for their business to withdraw and then set up sort of proactive efficiency plans for when we have drought conditions, which we will, like we've seen, you know, last summer and still, frankly, are in, that they can make adjustments to sort of limit water use during those periods when the water levels are really low. And again, it's a little different in each state, but, you know, at the moment, Vermont is so often the lead in so many things, so it's sort of interesting to me that in this case they're the last one to possibly get on board.
That's interesting. And Kathy, how could these plausible solutions impact businesses and Vermonters at large?
I think in general, from a business perspective, it will create more more reliable understanding and less risk, right? So, you know, if you're a business who's withdrawing surface waters, you need to know that it's going to be there for you. And so having some sort of system in place is actually really beneficial and can reduce some of the business risk involved. And then in terms of individual users, I mean, part of, you know, one of the considerations is you have different size streams. So there's different, you know, the Connecticut River is different than, you know, the Broad Brook or one of our smaller brooks. And so even a situation where you have someone who might be like withdrawing from a brook to fill a swimming pool, right? If everybody along that brook happens to start creating swimming pools, it can be a big impact if it's a small brook. So, you know, there's sort of a scale and a geographic question in terms of the actual streams, the size of the streams, and then the potential users of that stream. And it's different, you know.
Jared, why should Vermonters care about this issue? It seems, you know, one of those that I'm glad you are all invested in it. It's a little wonky, but what about the regular Vermonter? Why should they be really concerned and care about this?
Well, yeah, at this level, you know, what we've been discussing is certainly a little wonky, but I mean, Vermonters should have concerns about this issues on an economic level and on an environmental level. And on a recreational level, you know, as Kathy was saying, from in terms of the, you know, Vermont's economy, not only do we have, you know, some of our iconic, you know, economic sectors, including agriculture, which was expanding, you know, other uses, certainly need water in order for that certainty to survive and to carry their business on. From an environmental standpoint, of course, you know, Vermonters are concerned about their environment, you know, in their backyards and, you know, in the drought and impacts that that would have on, you know, not only aquatic and, you know, fish habitat, but also the impacts on other wildlife and other species and what that could have. And then from a recreational, you know, which certainly has a connection to our economy here in Vermont. I mean, we're seeing, you know, people come to Vermont for our environment and to recreate and to enjoy our outdoors. And that is certainly not only is, you know, it's not only is the mountains and the skiing, but in the summertime, it's fishing and it's boating, canoeing, rafting, all of these activities that people enjoy, on our rivers. And you can think about the amount of boat traffic, canoe traffic and people floating and, the swimming holes on the Mad River alone. You know, folks in this area think about how important the Mad River is to the economy, you know, going up into Waitsfield and such. And all of those rivers have such an important impact. Now think about trying to navigate the Mad River with, you know, with one third of the water that's in there normally. I mean, you're starting to talk about huge stresses on the recreational industry, on local economies, and everybody that relies on folks to come in, you know, spend the dollars and stay at the hotels, and eat at the restaurants. You know, I'm thinking post-COVID here. Obviously, we've certainly hit a speed bump in the last year, but
sure,
all those really important factors. So I think this has to be of a concern to Vermonters on all different levels.
Well, Jared, I want to tell you, I've been in this studio where I host the show from for, I think, 6 or 7 months now. And I don't always pay attention to all the things that are on the walls here. But when I walked in this morning, one jumped out at me because of its relevance. And it's a poster from Water Week 2017. And it says in large letters, "Water fuels our economy." And you really did kind of hit home how important water is to what we do here in Vermont.
Just so many different levels. I mean, like you were saying, you know, earlier in the show, that we're a wet state, and I think Vermonters sort of take all of it, take our waterways for granted. And I think folks in the last couple of years have really started to see, you know, the impact that climate change is having on, you know, think about the two extremes. I mean, there have been some cases in the last, I mean, Irene aside, which certainly impacted Waterbury a lot, but think about those cases of those really deluge events where suddenly you've got way too much water going through our rivers. I live in Montpelier. And then those events where we hit drought and there's not enough to recreate or to fish, and you're concerned about the environment. So I think Vermonters, this is an issue that is near and dear to us that that folks need to pay attention to.
Mason, forming a study group and looking into the problem is time consuming. And a lot of times these summer study groups, they come back and nothing gets done. The horse could be well and truly out of the barn. So why aren't we acting sooner? Why not push for legislative action to address the problem more immediately?
Good question, Rick. You know, Kathy had mentioned this earlier, and so did Jared. The study group is extremely important for a variety of reasons. And it all goes back to the fact that right now the state knows very little. They know a little, but they know very little about the extent of surface waters in Vermont, users, so those withdrawing water, surface waters, the impact and the impacts of those usages. And so the study group is looking into that, and the study group is also thinking, Rick, about the regulatory hole that we've discussed. And then, only then, is it tasked with advising the legislature on plausible solutions. So kind of circling back, the study group is really about wrapping our head around the issue, getting the data, and then making a reasoned decision after that.
Has the study group been formed already?
The study group has been formed. The study group has now met twice, and actually the study group will be meeting next Monday on May 17th. And during that meeting, experts will speak to the study group about specific issues. And then in June, the study group will be meeting again, where it will hear from a variety of national and international experts on some of the issues that we've been discussing this morning.
And will Vermonters have an opportunity to provide input to the study group at any point?
Yes, they will. So Vermonters can tune in to all of the study groups. They can submit comments both to, you know, their local legislators, and they can get involved in the study group process and submit comments to the state. You know, so it is a participatory process.
And Kathy Erfer, I'm going to jump back to kind of the jumping off point of all this was Killington using water from one water basin to make snow, and then it would drain into another water basin. So that's over in Killington. Why should your conservancy be concerned with what's happening in Killington?
Killington is in the Connecticut River watershed, Rick. So, I mean, literally the eastern half of Vermont is the Connecticut River watershed. So we don't focus, you know, a lot of people think we focus on just the main stem of the big river, but the, you know, rivers are systems. And so the health of downstream areas depends on upstream areas. So that's why we were involved. So, you know, when I was talking about the intrabasin transfer from the Ottauquechee into Otter Creek, the Ottauquechee is actually one of the tributary rivers that empties into the Connecticut.
Outstanding. All right. And as we've mentioned, your conservancy takes in New Hampshire, Mass, Connecticut, as well as Vermont. Have you seen surface water concerns in those states? We talked about you know, kind of the laws, the protections there. But have you seen concerns there and how they've been adequately addressed?
Well, it's a big area. As it is, I have Vermont and Hampshire, which is like, you know, 275 miles of river and, God, I don't know how many hundreds and hundreds of square miles. So I try to not, personally, I try to not pay attention to what's happening in Massachusetts, Connecticut, because my colleagues down there taking care of that.
All right.
So I can't give specific examples, but I can say that since those states already have a process in place, you can bet, and just based on population, increase, you know, impacts to waterways because of population and users, you know, you can bet there are concerns down there as well.
All right. Sorry for that massive question. I overreached a bit. Now, Jared, what other water issues in Vermont is Trout Unlimited concerned with right now?
Well, to you, you know, obviously we're concerned about, and we've been discussing, of course, water quantity, but of course, to you is also concerned about water quality, as you mentioned at the beginning of the show, mm-hmm. you know, issues with nutrient pollution and runoff and erosion. Reconnection of habitat is a big one for Trout Unlimited. Obviously, there are a lot of dams in this state. They're used for hydropower and other uses. But then there's a lot of, you know, what you call, there's about 1,100 of what you call derelict deadbeat dams that, you know, are impeding rivers, impeding habitat, impeding fish migration. And when you start talking about things like climate change and things like drought, dams and you know, and certain culverts and stuff really impede fish from being able to move from, get out of the warmer water and move upstream, you know, or into the deeper pools, into the colder water. So that's certainly an issue of ours. And TU and CRC certainly, other organizations are very interested in dams and dam removals of those derelict, deadbeat dams that aren't doing really anything. They can't generate hydro or offer any real purpose, but just sort of gum up the work, so to speak. So there's a lot of issues out there with water quality and water quantity that Vermonters really sort of need to, you know, as the summer goes on and you watch water levels fluctuate, to sort of think about, you know, all the impacts that, you know, and all the importance that our rivers and our lakes and ponds have in Vermont on our economy and our environment and on our recreational opportunities. So,
Mason Overstreet, if everything works out to the coalition's satisfaction with this act, what would it look like here in Vermont? What would get passed? What would the legislation affect?
You know, Rick, I think I may let Kathy answer that.
Great.
She's really kind of the spearhead of the coalition. Kathy, okay. Do you want to take that?
Sure. You know, what I think the best scenario would be for us to have a proactive system where everyone, you know, to a certain extent, this is an equity issue, right, in terms of treating the people who need access to our surface waters equitably and making sure that those uses are all protected, including the in-stream needs of the ecosystem. So, you know, part of the process of, you know, you asked Mason about, or Jared maybe, about just why not, you know, go ahead and put some regulation in place. You know, what we really want here is the conversation and the thoughtful development of how we do this proactively and cooperatively to support everyone who relies on our waterways. You know, I think that's kind of the Vermont way to a certain extent. It's finding our way through this in a neighborly fashion, so that we all know that our neighbors are also supported with what they need and that our species in the rivers are supported with what they need.
All right. I'm going to finish with a softball for Jason. For Jared. You have about 30 seconds left. Jared, how has trout season been so far?
Oh, you know, yeah, it's a softball, but it's such a softball. I haven't been out on the river.
Oh!
We've had I know. Every time I have a minute, the water's really high.
Yeah.
But it's funny. Like I said, we've really seen the fluctuations. Some guys were out. You know, members of our organization were out early in the year during that real warm spell when the waters were low, and they were noticing the water temperatures were already up in the 50s. And that's rare for Vermont in March. So I know folks have been out. I know the stocking has been happening, and folks have been out in the headwaters and such, and doing okay. But unfortunately, no, I've been chained to Zoom a little bit too much. So unfortunately.
All right, that's Jared Carpenter, vice chair of the Vermont Council of Trout Unlimited, president of the Mad Dog chapter of Trout Unlimited. Kathy Erfer has also been here with us this hour. She's river steward for the Connecticut River Conservancy, and Mason Overstreet, professor of law in Vermont Law School's Environmental Advocacy Clinic. Thank you all three for spending the hour with us this morning.
Thank you, Rick.
You're welcome. All right, we're going to take a break for CBS News. We'll be back to hear about CVU access here on Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV.
Let our staff at the Warren Store ease you back into a pre-pandemic lifestyle. We can cater your postponed events and even bake you a custom cake. We can dress you in comfortable casual clothing. Make it a day trip for the best one-stop shopping in Vermont. Have lunch on our deck, head upstairs for some much-needed retail therapy, then treat yourself to a specialty coffee from our new espresso machine. You can pick up a colorful Warren Store beach towel for a dip in the river, and how about a delicious house-made ice cream sandwich? Fun, funky, safe, and friendly. Warren Store, Main Street, Warren Village, and warrenstore.com.
Welcome back to Vermont Viewpoint. Okay, let's shift gears a little here. If you're a CPA who'd love to learn how to jitterbug, or a dancer who'd like to know how to do your own taxes, please pay heed. Take a look into Access CVU. It's a decades-old program that helps adults learn new things. A local leader in community education, Access CVU strives to provide enrichment and learning opportunities for anyone, anywhere. You can explore new passions, ignite your imagination, learn a new skill, connect with lifelong learners. Laura Howard is the program director of Access CVU, and she's here to talk about the work that they do. Laura, welcome to Vermont Viewpoint.
Hi, Rick. Hi. Thanks for having me.
Oh, it's great to have you. Listeners, if you have a question about Access CVU, or maybe you've taken a class through the program, you can give us a call, 244-1777, 877-291-8255. You can also email vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. Laura, give us a little history lesson of Access CVU. When and how did it get started?
Sure. Access was inspired by a community call for accessible and affordable education. It was founded via a grant in 2000 by Eddie Krasno of Charlotte. Eddie has a great passion for volunteering within the community, and it led him to a vision of wanting to bring towns and community members together in a centralized place, a public building that everyone owns, is vacant in the evening and can host classes and really bring just, you know, a great connection through education. So in 2000, Access CVU, which is a nonprofit organization, was born, and it has grown since then into one of the largest community education programs in the state, serving all towns, all ages, that's sort of the brief history of it.
Well done. Now, before COVID, were all the classes held at the high school?
Yes, they were. All classes have been held traditionally at CVU within the campus, but we had to, of course, pivot quite quickly, which I can speak to, given COVID last year.
All right, we will get to that. But what are generally the length of classes? You know, what time of year are they held? What times of day?
Sure. So Access runs classes following the school CVU schedule. So we run two semesters. All our classes fall in the evening hours. Generally, anything after 5 o'clock, we try to avoid all school sports, and then the building is empty. So we like to fill it with classes both fall-winter semester and winter-spring semester. So it's basically from September through mid-June, and we do observe all the school holidays and vacations and such.
What are the... Go ahead. No, please go right ahead.
No, it's about 16 weeks of learning per semester.
And what are the categories of classes that you offer?
Well, currently we are offering about 11 categories. Our largest category is a fine arts and crafts category. We offer everything within there, from wood to ceramics to visual arts, watercolor, basket weaving, welding, wood bowl turning, you name it. Ceramic wheel and hand building. You know, we try to utilize the studios within the building and what they offer to create classes as well. We have dance, fitness, yoga. We have cuisine, which is very popular, very exciting. We have CVU put in a new kitchen last year. So anybody that's taken Access cooking classes will be welcoming back to a new space within the building. We do health and wellness, holistic classes. Another large category is home and garden. We have everything from dog training, growing mushrooms, land management. We have kids and teen classes, fun and games, such as Mahjong, bridge. And then we go into our standards, which are language classes, French, Italian, Spanish, music, and photography classes. So that's the sort of the smattering of what we have. And then we do offer another specialized category called Access Speaker Series.
Oh, tell us about that.
So the Access Speaker Series was something that we has been ongoing, where we basically host presentations of amazing stories, historical events, useful information from local authors and field experts. So we could have anybody from the Alzheimer's Association to somebody who's an expert on understanding lake ice. And then we have Vermont, as I'm sure many people know, has a great number of authors. And so we'd like to invite them to do live presentations when possible to the community, where people can meet, ask questions. We have Jack Mayer has been someone who wrote Before the Court of Heaven. We have other experts like Charlotte Albers. She's an expert on gardens around the world. She'll do a beautiful presentation with slideshows of gardens she's visited. We have the Maritime Museum come, so Lake Champlain Maritime Museum. And then we have a new presenter this year was Adam Krakowski, who wrote The History of Cocktails and Prohibition in Vermont. And he's hosted a wonderful series of the history of spirits. Understanding that. And the COVID connection was obviously very relevant. That was with Barry Genslinger. He's an expert. And then you see Elise Guyette. She's an author. She did The History of Lincoln Hill, which is a story taking place of black farming communities, or actually right here in Hinesburg.
That's right.
So a big smattering. And we do invite anybody in an expert field to come and join us and present.
Wow, that's wonderful. You mentioned Jack Mayer in one of his books. I'm going to throw out another title if someone hasn't read Life in a Jar, which is nonfiction and a really amazing story of Irina Sendler during World War II. Now, Laurel Howard, what is your role with Access CVU?
So I'll go back a little bit. Eddie Krasno, who, like I said, ran the program for over 20 years, retired timely right before COVID, and the transition for CVSD, which Access operates under or within as its own entity, needed to have someone to carry the reins. And I trained with Eddie for 3 years before he retired. And together with my partner, Jen Morton, who has also been with the program for a few years now, we run the show. We run the show during the day, but I would be remiss in saying we are not the only people that make this happen. We have great support from CVSD, who are our administrators, and our STARS, which are the custodians, which you know, obviously help keep the building clean and safe. And then we have many volunteers in the evening that welcome people into the building. And so together with the teachers, and it's a team effort.
Very good. So who mainly takes the classes? Where are they from? How old are they? You know, what are their backgrounds?
That's a good question. So the mission of Access is to offer classes for all ages, all towns, and with now virtual learning, anywhere. Traditionally speaking, most of our classes have been a senior community. We have seen the accessibility, though, now coming towards more. And that always trends, depend on what classes we offer, obviously. Mm-hmm. But turning towards a little bit more of somebody in their demographic, 40s, 50s, it varies. You know, we offer such a wide breadth of classes that the community, it speaks to, there's something that speaks to everybody. We have people as far as across the lake, New York, come and take our classes. They make the trek on the ferries, and as far as Montpelier, you know, it is evening classes, so there's always the snow days and the inclement weather, but most people come from as far and as near as drivable.
Mm-hmm. And Laura, are the classes taken for personal fulfillment, or are there any classes for credit?
We do not offer credited courses at this time. We offer most of our classes for pure enjoyment. Somebody has an interest or a passion in a certain field and wants to have an introductory class. Most of our classes are introductory classes that have actually launched careers or very successful hobbies. One example would be Beekeeping Basics with Bill Mars. We've had over 1,000 graduates in the 20 years that he's hosted this class. So you'll have a lot of beekeepers out there. We have some, you know, juggling. People have taken juggling at Access and are now, you know, professional entertainers. Mm-hmm. Or another big one would be ceramics. They started with a class offered on wheel throwing. And now they're professional potters. So many of our classes are hobbyists language classes. There's another one. You know, you're going on a trip. You want to brush up your Spanish or your French. You can come and take a class with us.
And Laura, how much do classes cost? Is there a range of charges for classes that people take at Access CVU?
That's a good question, Rick. Classes, since we have such a varied offering of different genres, they're all over the place. One of the things and one of the missions of Access is to keep classes affordable for our learning community. You know, we do want to invite anyone that is interested in learning, and we do have a limited scholarship fund for anybody in need as well. So that's our goal. You know, with having Access at the CVSD facility, we have been able to keep learning affordable. And classes will range. We have some classes that are one night only classes. $15 to $20, or we'll offer yoga classes that run 14 weeks, or watercolor classes. And so the prices do vary, but they are well attended, and like I said, accessible to all.
And Laura, you mentioned that it was started back in 2000 from a grant. How is Access CVU funded today?
So Access CVU is a nonprofit. It's funded through the class fees. We rely on those primarily as our source, but also we have very generous donations from community members. And we also have some community sponsors as well, businesses in the area that have very much enjoyed taking Access classes and see the value in community education.
You've mentioned some of the classes that you offer. Are there any new ones or unusual ones maybe that people wouldn't think that might be offered through a program like this?
Yes, and there are some unusual ones, and we continually strive to add new instructors and new classes. You'll find that every semester there'll be 20 to 30 new classes and at least 10 to 20 new instructors. So there's always something new at Access. I can give you a couple things that you may not know that we offer.
Please do.
We offer cake decorating. We offer Reiki, self-hypnosis. We do offer a very popular class for those that are looking for skills, which is welding. So that's a popular class. Yeah. We have harmonica. Yodeling, there will be a new one this fall. We will be doing many dietary classes, cutting sugar out of your diet or how to embrace the gluten-free trends. One of the classes that I'd like to mention, because it's a nice relationship we have with the CVU students, is we offer community tech support. With computers, phones, people having issues can call us, and we pair them up with a CVU student who generally the students are very savvy and technical, and they help community members. So that's a nice offering that we have as well.
Laura, I noticed a little lilt in your voice when you mentioned yodeling. Is that something you're considering?
I don't think so, no. I think I'll pass on the yodeling.
All right, just checking. All right, now, how do you find your instructors, and what do they have to do to teach at Access CVU?
Sure. So instructors, I'm always blown away by the talent that we have available, our local talent, and how many people are willing to teach a community class and share their knowledge or their expertise. We brainstorm in the office. We keep an eye on what's trending. If there's a new trend, macrame is trending right now. So how would that process start? We survey the community. Does anybody know anyone that teaches macrame? We ask for class suggestions. Does anybody in the community have a suggestion of a class they would like to take at Access? And we feel other suggestions, and from there we ask. We have a newsletter that goes out every week. We ask in the newsletter, and really it's a word of mouth type process.
And you say you get new teachers every time, every semester, but do you have some who are been serving there at Access CVU for quite a while?
We certainly do. We have many teachers. We probably have a core of about 50 teachers that have been a member of Access, giving back to the community for over 15 years. Mm-hmm. Some have been since the beginning. Bill Mars, I mentioned him with beekeeping. We have Ginny Joyner with watercolor. We had a welding teacher that just retired, Bruce Hathaway. We have some some cooking teachers that have been with us for a very long time, Vivian Levy, Alganesh Michael. So yes, we have, you'll find it's a very fun and engaging and enjoyable place to teach, because it's not an accredited course. It's a place to come, connect, have fun, and learn.
Yeah, that's wonderful. Now, when we started this conversation, I asked you about where things were held, and they're, you know, held at CVU, but you said, pre-COVID. Now, how have things changed during COVID?
It was a pivotal year for Access. The Vermont Department of Education guidelines was they would prefer no public access to educational buildings. So we had a crossroads. We could either close the program down for a year, or we could bring enrichment to the community through online learning and outdoor classes as well. We chose the latter. After surveying the community and saying, what would you like us to do? Would you be interested and would you take virtual classes? And we had an overwhelming response of over 500 people that said, yes, we need access during this time. So it was a steep learning curve. We had to pivot, ask our instructors to teach virtually. We went from about 220 classes offering in the fall to about 150. And many of our instructors said, well, I don't know how we're going to do this, but I'm willing to learn. Many of our community members said, I've never done virtual learning, but I'm willing to learn. Hmm. And both Jen and myself said, well, I guess we'll become Zoom experts overnight. And we all came together, and it was a slow start, but the feedback and the welcome distraction for the community has been just overwhelming. We have offered and learned so much, and there's so much appreciation for something to do as we were all isolating. And the silver lining of this past year is that virtual learning has found a place at Access. And it's going to be a welcome addition to our program going forward. Nothing replaces, of course, in-person learning and that connection. But there's a place for virtual learning. You know, many of our senior community don't like driving at night or during inclement weather. They may live too far from CVU, or they just enjoy tuning in from the comfort of their home. So the great thing is that we had families connect at our classes from Seattle, Florida, Washington, D.C., taking a myriad of classes together. Mm-hmm. And it was just a great way to connect, an easy way to connect. And that's going to continue. So we're very, very happy with and very used to the virtual platform now.
Wow, 220 classes normally. That is a staggering total, Laura. Well done. We only have about 30 seconds left, but any advice for people who've put off trying something new because they're not so young anymore, don't think they're good at something, too busy, a lot of excuses, but what do you tell people to get them to sign up for Access CVU?
Call us. We're very friendly. Come to a class, come take a class, no obligation. All our classes are guaranteed. Guaranteed funds, though, I promise that. And just give us a try. We're very welcoming to everyone. And also come out to our craft fairs. We're hosting our craft fair this fall. Very exciting. October 16th and November 27th. Come visit us at CVU for those.
All right. Way to get that plug in right at the end. Laura Howard is the program director of Access CVU. Laura, thank you so much for letting us know about these programs. I'll see you in harmonica class.
Great. Thanks, Rick.
All right. We're going to hop out for CBS News. And when we get back, we're going to visit the Stern Center in Williston. And don't forget, tonight on WDEV, we're going to have the Red Sox as they return to Fenway to open a 3-game series against the AL West leading Oakland A's. Coverage begins tonight at 6:10, first pitch at 7:10. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV.
Let our staff at the Warren Store ease you back into a pre-pandemic lifestyle. We can cater your postponed events and even bake you a custom cake. We can dress you in comfortable casual clothing. Make it a day trip for the best one-stop shopping in Vermont. Have lunch on our deck, head upstairs for some much-needed retail therapy, then treat yourself to a specialty coffee from our new espresso machine. You can pick up a colorful Warren Store beach towel for a dip in the river, and how about a delicious house-made ice cream sandwich? Fun, funky, safe, and friendly. Warren Store, Main Street, Warren Village, and warrenstore.com.
Welcome back to Vermont Viewpoint. Great minds do not all think alike, as it turns out, and they most definitely don't learn alike. Enter the Stern Center, a nonprofit educational organization that works to help all learners reach their academic, social, and professional goals. The center also develops professional learning programs for educators across the country. We're now joined by Dr. Lori Quinn, who recently stepped into the role of president of the Stern Center, only the second person to hold that position in the organization's 38 years. Dr. Quinn, it is so great to have you on this program this morning. Welcome.
Thanks so much for having me, Rick, and thanks for your interest in our work at the Stern Center.
Oh, you're welcome. Listeners, to ask a question about the Stern Center or to let us know if you've seen their work in action, you can call us at 244-1777 or 877-291-8255. Lori, how would you describe the Stern Center and the work that you do?
Well, you know, you framed it well, Rick. We're a not-for-profit educational impact organization. We focus on really three primary areas. We do evaluation for individuals, and that looks like helping with expertise and testing for assessment of differences and disabilities. And many families, as well as schools, seek us out for that work and for our team of experts in evaluation. We also have a robust instructional part of our practice, and our educators work one-on-one with students. They work with small groups of students based both at our center in Williston and at schools throughout the state of Vermont to give some specific coaching and intervention to students who, as you very rightly said, learn differently, but have no less potential to learn and to thrive. And then finally, our professional learning work really equips teachers in the K-12 grades to be the most informed and expert instructors that they possibly can, able to reach every learner in their classroom or through special education efforts. And so all of that rolls up into the multitude of ways that the Stern Center is working to make a difference with literacy and language learning, as well as in the fields of mathematics, social learning, and communication, and really contributing to the field through our own research and efforts with education, all the way from the individual to the system at the school level and district level.
When the center was founded in the 80s, what was the main impetus then, and how has that changed, grown, shifted since then?
Yeah, you know, our brilliant founding president, now our president emerita, Dr. Blanche Podiesky, a speech and language expert, noticed when she was working with young children that for some students, the process of learning to read seemed to go pretty smoothly and naturally. And I'm sure for your listeners, we've seen this, those of us raising kids have seen that for some readers, the decoding of words seems to, you know, proceed along as you'd expect. And eventually that process of making sense of the letters and connecting them to the sounds that we learn in oral language in the world, all that happens pretty naturally for some learners. But for somewhere between, estimates are about 15 to 20% of our students who may have some aspect of dyslexia happening in the way that their brain learns, that link between sounds and print just doesn't come as quickly. It doesn't come as naturally. And what we're learning through brain research is so fascinating because we see through the brain imaging studies that what the brain is actually doing when some learners are reading is using different circuits to process the print that we see with our eyes and make sense of once we become fluid and skilled readers. And so the Stern Center's approach to teaching reading is based on those evidence-driven methods that make sure that regardless of how a particular learner is wired, if you will, in their brain, we are able to help them become a skilled reader, a decoder of print in ways that are just extraordinary to witness. And I'm incredibly privileged to lead an organization that's having that kind of impact for individuals, because we know that when you fall behind in reading, and this often shows up right around the fourth grade assessments, when you begin to fall behind, the longer-term consequences of that for your ability to learn, to thrive, to graduate, to be employed, and to contribute can be quite severe. And so the hope that everybody will just somehow magically catch up has proven, sadly, not to be true. And timely action and intervention can make an enormous difference at all of those levels, for the individual, for the family, for the community, and, you know, more broadly for all of us in society.
You mentioned leading the organization, the Stern Center. Can you talk about taking the reins from Dr. Podaisky and, you know, what you're bringing to the job?
Sure. Well, I'm greatly indebted to Blanche. She was a visionary founder, and the work of the Stern Center has really been shaped by that vision that she brought over so many years. I'm about 3 months into my work as the Stern Center's second president,
wow.
And I'm having a wonderful time. I'm learning even more deeply about the kind of impacts that we've had over the years and where we can go next. It's a great time to be having an in-depth conversation and making a plan for how do we make sure that every learner has access to what they need, and how do we coach and mentor our teachers to really feel that they can make a difference, right? It's been such a tough time for learners and teachers as we've tried to navigate, and not to mention those of us who are parents, as we've tried to navigate this pandemic and really come out on the other side with a sense of what's possible for students in their learning. And frankly, also to know what doesn't work. And have the courage to move our systems away from the methods that are not really delivering for every learner. And so the Stern Center wants to be part of that, and I'm so thrilled to be taking the helm of a strong organization that's really poised to help make a difference in that conversation that I know is unfolding not only statewide but really nationally as we stare down some reading scores that could be a heck of a lot better and could be serving our young folks much more powerfully than they are today.
Let's talk about who the students are, who you serve. Is there any geographical limitation from where you'll take students from?
Well, no. With the power of technology, we have been able to amplify our reach, and that's been exciting. Right now, as I mentioned, our main center is in Williston, so that is our home base. But we have statewide reach, particularly through our work with schools. So schools all across the state of Vermont and throughout the New England region partner with us. And increasingly, nationally, our profile is gaining. Not only because of the impact that we've had on the conversation around what works, but also because we are developing new programs. For example, we have a program in early literacy called Building Blocks. And the Building Blocks program has piqued interest from different pockets around the country, including in the state of Pennsylvania, where we recently connected with some colleagues who are working on an early literacy initiative and were impressed and excited by the content that we had put together to help those working directly with our littlest readers, our very beginning readers, to make sure that they have the right foundation for literacy learning. And it's quite striking when you come to understand just how limited the preparation of so many of our teachers is in literacy, not for lack of effort or good intentions, But there's a lot that gets missed in preparing our teachers to serve every learner with literacy in particular. And so we hear frequently from the educators that we work with how relieved and empowered they feel to understand some of what the research is showing us about what's happening in their students' brains when the student is struggling with reading, and more importantly, what we can do about it. The good news is that about 95% of readers can, in fact, learn to read with the right methods. And so this is not a lost cause by any stretch of the imagination. We've got an opportunity with the right teacher education and with the reach of the Stern Center and other organizations doing work like us to really move the needle for young people in their capability to learn.
Lori, I'd love to get an idea of the size of the Stern Center, you know, how big your staff is, how many children you work with each year, how many educators.
Sure. So we have reached about 600 students in the most recent year, and about 2,000 educational professionals. So all in, we're looking at about 3,000, just over 3,000 individuals served. And that breaks out in different ways at different times depending on our initiative. Right now what we're seeing is a tremendous demand for a program we have called Lead to Read. Lead to Read is our school partnership program. And perhaps not surprisingly, coming out of the COVID era, we are seeing the demand for teacher education and for system-wide intervention with students really increase. And so we're hearing from principals, we're hearing from superintendents, and we're hearing from the grassroots, the teachers in classrooms, about the desire to help students with any learning loss that they have experienced during this pandemic. But also, I think that the pandemic has also prompted a fresh look at how learning actually is unfolding, right? It's that time when we reassess so much. And I'm just thrilled with the response that we're seeing from our school partners to really commit to getting this right for every learner.
Dr. Quinn, can you talk about a few different kinds of learners and how they might need their education adjusted to better suit them?
Yes. So when you think about, let's think about a young reader who is a very bright young person doing well in all aspects of school, with the exception of the reading instruction, which is going slowly and beginning to frustrate this otherwise well-motivated young student, right? So that student may be referred to us by a pediatrician, by someone at their school, or by a parent who feels really a desire to understand just what's happening with this aspect of their academics. And so we would work with that student through the evaluation process and then through some corresponding customized instruction to help with any catching up or specific strategies moving forward that would allow that particular learner to really master the fundamentals of reading fluently. And we do that through a few different methods. We actually are open to any evidence-driven method that shows results at the Stern Center. One of those methods is called Orton-Gillingham. And Orton-Gillingham is actually named for Orton and Gillingham, the two founders of the method, one of whom was a neuroscientist and a psychologist, and another of whom was a classroom educator. Hmm. So really the perfect blend of two minds who had a lot of experience, and this is going back decades now, a lot of experience seeing the struggles that some readers had when they were trying to acquire those skills. And what the Orton-Gillingham method, as it's known today, brings into practice is all of that insight from the research on the brain and how the brain learns and how learning unfolds in the best possible classroom environment. And so we use that method, we use others both with our students in the individual instruction and small group instruction program, and also in training teachers to use those methods in their classroom.
You've mentioned a couple times the importance of the student evaluation. So what goes into evaluating a student and then designing a learning plan for them?
Yeah, that's an important, really important piece of our work and our contribution, I think, to success for every learner. So our team of evaluators is really quite an extraordinary collection of experts. We have a mix of school psychologists, of trained psychiatrists, and of speech and language experts. And so together, the team will determine what are the right kinds of evaluative and assessments, what are the right kinds of assessments for the learner who comes to our door and is struggling in one way or another. So, of course, we want to understand what is the student, what are their family members, or if it's an adult learner, what are they seeing in their day-to-day that's brought them to this set of questions about how they learn. And then we want to tailor those assessments through an evaluation to understand, okay, what are your learning strategies? And then, as you said, the instructional program will follow from what we learn about how this person learns best. What strategies do they need? So it's been quite remarkable to see our team working through the pandemic with social distancing and safety protocols in place. And part of what we've noticed is the resilience of learners. When you struggle with reading or other kinds of, for example, social learning and communication, as we might see with students on the autism spectrum, you learn pretty quickly, I think, to build up your ability to bounce back from the frustrations in your day-to-day. And so while we were concerned about how evaluations and assessments might look and feel to our learners during the pandemic, we have been so impressed with their ability to be evaluated from a distance, to work with us through partitions and sometimes wearing masks when we can't sufficiently distance. As the different regulations of the pandemic have unfolded, we've followed them closely and made sure that we keep everybody safe. But, you know, the motivation that somebody feels to understand their own learning is a constant source of inspiration to us, and the ability to help them unlock this puzzle of, why is this hard for me? Why is this harder for me than it is for somebody else? That process is incredibly empowering and important, and it's very rewarding to see that unfold when our evaluation team is able to help somebody understand and move forward with the right tools and the right strategies.
And Lori, we only have a couple minutes left, but I do want to make sure we address the other side of the equation of the work that the Stern Center does, and that is the development of professional learning programs for educators. So you can tell us a bit about that aspect and where these educators are coming from, what grade levels they are that you instruct.
Sure. Well, we reach teachers from all different grade levels who are interested in honing their practice around a whole range of topics. In fact, we have been recently expanding the kinds of offerings that we are able to provide. And again, this is one of the upsides of the pandemic, right? This is our ability to say, what does work well in online learning and distance learning? The Stern Center for many years has done both in-person teacher training and virtual. And what I think is so powerful is for us to realize how we can add new topics very quickly from our experts to work with teachers who have set specific professional learning goals for themselves. And so I mentioned our Lead to Read initiative and our Building Blocks for Literacy initiative. We've also been working with many teachers on the Orton-Gillingham method. This is an intense and complex, really, set of professional knowledge that increasingly teachers are eager to bring to their classroom practice. And so we've seen great demand for learning the Orton-Gillingham method. We do certainly see many teachers at the elementary levels seeking out Stern Center professional learning, just given how much concentration there is on those foundational reading skills at those grade levels. But we're also beginning to work more and more with middle school educators and principals who are interested in what happens when a student gets as far as seventh grade and reading still isn't fluent. Right? How do we make a smart impact for that student to allow them to loop back to master some fundamentals, but also to be ready for the content in subjects like science, where you might not think reading plays such a critical role, but in fact, if you can't read fluently, it's really difficult to understand the science content that you then are going to apply in your science course. So you can see how across the different subject areas and the different grade levels, the educator learning that we're contributing to is really having an impact classroom by classroom. And we love working with teachers. It's incredibly rewarding.
Dr. Lori Quinn is the president of the Stern Center. And teachers, parents, you can learn more at sterncenter.org. Lori, thank you so much for being on Vermont Viewpoint this morning.
My pleasure, Rick. Thanks a lot for your time.
Sure thing. Take care. And that is our show for today. Vermont Viewpoint is produced by Shayla Connor Shapiro, directed by Danny McGivrigan. Our email address is vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. So please send in suggestions for topics or guests. What have we got? We've got the Governor's COVID-19 Response News Conference coming up after CBS News this morning. I'm Rick Singeri. I'll meet you back here tomorrow.